It is only one of the points where mind touches body, the others being the ductless glands of the endocrine system, the pineal, pituitary, thyroid, adrenals, thymus and gonads, to which may be added the solar plexus and sacral plexus. The student of tantric physiology will be very dull if he has not observed that the chakras coincide in their physical location with the endocrine organs. Now the endocrines have for their task the maintenance of the chemical composition of the blood. They pour into it their secretions, called hormones, in certain balanced proportions. If the balance is in any way upset, either by an overplus of one secretion or shortage of another, profound changes in metabolism take place. The whole of the life processes are regulated by the endocrines, and can be speeded up or slowed down in their different aspects as the balance of the endocrines alters. This endocrine balance is known by physiologists to be intimately associated with emotional states, and especially with the alertness or stolidity of the temperament. Psychologists do not sufficiently appreciate the importance of the recent work upon the endocrines, but occultists have a knowledge of this aspect of psychophysiology as part of their traditional teaching. The breathing exercises of the yoga system are based upon this knowledge, and are exceedingly potent, as are all occult practices which are brought through correctly to the physical plane. In fact, we may say that no occult process is really potent, nor can it be said to have completed its circuit, unless it has its point of contact with dense matter, a point which many occultists leave out of their calculations. Occultism, though primarily a mental process, is not a purely mental process. It is both spiritual and material. In the great majority of cases of insanity, organic brain changes cannot be demonstrated. But alienists are more and more coming to recognize that they may look for the use of Hecate in the blood. Its chemical composition may depart from normal, whether owing to a change in the hormone balance or to the byproducts of disease. This change in the blood chemistry is immediately followed by a change in the emotional tone. It may become over-emotional or depressed, apathetic or irritable. The ancients described these conditions admirably as the four humors: the sanguine, the bilious, the lymphatic and the choleric. It has been abundantly demonstrated by physiologists that emotional states affect the chemical composition of the blood. It is gradually being realized that these changes are brought about through the mediation of the ductless glands, which may be called the emotional brain, just as the gray matter within the skull may be called the sensory motor brain. It follows, therefore, that if through some interference with their functioning the glands produce a blood composition corresponding to that produced by them when a particular emotional state is giving its special stimulus, the individual will experience the physical sensations associated with the corresponding emotional state. His mind will proceed to adjust itself to these conditions by accounting for them through the imagination as best it may. So that if there is a state of the blood characteristic of the condition of fear, fear images will arise in the mind. It is upon this basis that the organic insanities produce their characteristic mental states. Whether the emotional state be due to a mental cause or a physical cause, the result is the same for the patient. Organic insanities are distinguished from functional ones solely by their origin. An organic insanity tends to depart further from the normal than a functional nervous disorder, because in the latter a considerable degree of compensation takes place, for the patient can to a great extent pull himself together and keep himself from going to disastrous extremes. This is not the case with an organic insanity, which proceeds to its logical conclusion. It is for this reason that a neurotic, although he may suffer severely, seldom has a complete breakdown unless he is sure of the necessities of life. The self-preservation instinct keeps him on his feet. Having considered the physical and subjective bases of mental disturbances, we are now in a position to assess accurately the part played by the unseen. What happens when a neurotic takes up occultism? We can best answer this question by considering what happens when a normal person takes up occultism. He learns for the first time of the existence of the invisible worlds and begins to think about them. Immediately he does this, he comes into touch with them. At first he may not be able to perceive them consciously, Nevertheless, he is feeling them subconsciously and they are affecting him. His life shows this to the close observer in a thousand ways. There are great forces moving like currents in the unseen, and we are drawn into these according to our temperamental affinity for them. The violent personality is drawn into the current of Mars, the emotional, suggestible one into the sphere of Luna. The influences of these spheres play upon them. Now the occultist, working under a proper system, knowing that he has got to meet these forces sooner or later, picks them up one by one voluntarily and by means of the appropriate rituals, and synthesizes them within his own nature. He knows too that each aspect has its obverse. The Virgin Mary is reflected in Lilith. The older faiths knew this, but popular Christianity, which has no roots in tradition, has forgotten it. Protestant Christianity threw away its occult aspect at the Reformation. All the pagan pantheons have gross aspects of divinities as well as ethereal ones. We need to search the refuse heap of history for the lost parts of our own tradition if our faith is to be complete, and the most profitable line of search is in the Kabbalah and the Gnostic literature. The literature of the Gnosis has been largely destroyed by systematic persecution, but in the Kabbalah there is still left as a complete system. The Jews, being strictly monotheistic, did not speak of gods, but they recognized a hierarchy of angels and archangels, which is the equivalent of the pagan pantheons. It is through these ethereal messengers that the All-Father formed the worlds. Let us consider once more the Kabbalistic doctrine of the Klippoth, for it is an intimate bearing upon the problem of insanity. The doctrine of the 10 holy Sephiroth, arranged in their correct pattern to form the Tree of Life, is invaluable in enabling us to conceive the invisible. The first Sephiru is concentrated out of the unmanifest, the point within the circle. This emanates the second, which in its turn emanates the third. As soon as one has emanated another, these two are said to be equilibrated, but when emanation is in process, there is a period of unbalanced force. This, as it were, goes off by itself in the cosmos and establishes a sphere of its own, unconnected with the cosmic system. Consequently, each sphere of the cosmos has its counterpart in chaos, in miniature, it is true, but nevertheless potent and functional. Each sphere, in the course of its evolution, builds up an oversoul which is called by different names and different systems. In the Kabbalistic system we call them the archangels, the spirits before the throne. The sphere of the sun is represented by Raphael, the sphere of the moon by Gabriel. The obverse Sephiroth, or Klippoth, build up in exactly the same way. In the habitations of hell these two are known as the disputers and the obscene ones, whose names sufficiently indicate their characters. The sphere of the sun is also the point of manifestation of the Messiah or Savior upon earth. The Prince of Peace has his obverse in the disputers. Who that has had the vision beautiful does not know the reaction that follows it, and the need of wisdom, self-control and patience to deal with the forces that are released not only in the soul but in the environment. It is for this reason that periods of purgation and discipline precede all revelations. We must keep the vigil before we can sit at the feast. Consciousness, released from the sphere of earth, rises straight upwards to the sphere of the moon. This is the negative, feminine, receptive, psychic sphere. From thence it passes onwards to the sphere of the Sunday. This is the positive, masculine sphere of the higher consciousness, the vision of the seer as distinguished from the psychic. Upon either hand the path is flanked by the spheres of hermetic wisdom and elemental beauty. These spheres, which have to do with the grades of initiation, need not concern us in the present pages. We shall only have to do with the sphere of the moon, Luna, the mistress of the lunatic. Now Luna was represented by the ancients under diverse forms as Diana the chaste huntress, symbol of sublimation, and Hecate, patroness of witchcraft and childbirth. We have already noted that the Klippoth of the sphere of Luna are called the obscene ones. Hence it is that when the unstable soul advances by the path of Saturn that bridges the astral and enters the sphere of Luna, he touches her Hecate aspect and finds himself in rapport with the Gamaliel, the obscene ones, whose chief is Lilith, she who giveth lustful dreams. Need we then wonder that Freud finds the dreams of the neurotic filled with sexual images in their most perverted and debased forms? The rabbis knew their psychology just as well as he does. 58. As has already been noted, the neurotic is very often psychic, and the psychic is very often neurotic. What may we expect to happen to the soul that has taken initiation in a past life, retains subconsciously the psychic development thus conferred, and finds itself incarnated in a neurotic personality in this life? He will come under the dark dominion of the moon, and Lilith will be his mistress. Through the ill-fitting doors of the neurotic temperament, the forces of the abyss find ingress. The dissociated complexes of the microcosm are reinforced by the dissociated complexes of the macrocosm, for that is precisely what the Klipoth are. Occultists and their ignorant admirers, the superstitious, have always held that insanity had to do with demonic possession. Modern medicine disputes this, and declares the various manifestations of the diseased mind to be due entirely to subjective psychological processes. At present, these two schools of thought are like two armed camps, drawn up for battle and shaking their weapons at each other. Each is too sure of his own ground to be willing to give the other a hearing. It is my belief that a common ground can be found for the meeting of these two opposing viewpoints. Psychology demonstrates the mechanism of the mind and can explain the mental processes whereby the ideas of the deranged assume their ultimate form. It can show the connection between these ideas and the dreams of the normal mentality. What it cannot explain is the fundamental difference between these subjective states and the normal waking consciousness. It is here that the occultist can tell the psychologist something that it is worth his while to hear, for he can show how these visions can be produced experimentally and at will by means of ceremonial magic. And still more important, the occultist can show him how these visions can be dispersed and the psychic faculties closed down and sealed. This brings us to the practical part of our considerations. How far can the methods of ritual magic be applied to the relief of mental disease? They are undoubtedly palliative, but they will not produce a permanent cure unless the origin of the disturbed mental condition is found and cleared up. Unless this be done, as fast as we disperse the phantoms, they will reform, because the mental state of the patient is invoking them. Under such circumstances, no magic circle can be kept intact. As fast as we break the rapport with the abyss, the patient renews it. But such conditions constitute a vicious circle. The clipotic forces with which a contact has been established will actively develop it, and will hold on to their victim when attempts are made to dislodge them. In this rationalistic age, we are apt to forget that there is such a thing as organized and intelligent evil. If the physical causes of this disturbance have been cleared up, the septic focus eradicated, or the tumor pressing upon the ductless gland excised, and still the mentality does not return to normal, an exorcism will often produce immediate and marked results. In the case of the neurotic, whose trouble is entirely in the sphere of the mind, an exorcism is of enormous value as a preliminary to the appropriate psychotherapeutic treatment because it clears the ground and prevents reinfection, giving the patient a chance to make a fresh start. It is possible for the clipotic demons to gain so powerful a hypnotic influence over a victim that he is powerless to break it by any effort of his own will, nor can the orthodox type of psychotherapy touch the root of the trouble. The exorcism may have to be repeated two or three times in the course of the treatment, because the rapports may be renewed after they have been broken. But once the patient's complexes have been cleared up, they will not return. In any case, an exorcism produces marked temporary benefit. During the lull, the patient gets a chance to pull himself together and the evil influences are undermined. A courageous patient, who is cooperating intelligently, will seldom have to be exorcised more than three times provided material conditions are favorable. I have seen cases cleared by a single exorcism, and remaining well indefinitely so long as the patient obeyed instructions and had nothing whatever to do with the unseen, neither reading books upon occultism nor associating with people who were interested in such subjects, and I have also seen the abyss re-establish its influence when the patient disobeyed instructions and reawakened the old vibrations. We need to realize that the human consciousness is not a closed vessel, but like the body, has a continual intake and output. The cosmic forces are circulating through it all the time, like seawater through a living sponge. Whatever emotional state may arise within us is reinforced from outside. The subjective self only has the kindling, the cosmos supplies the fuel. Once the fire is started, the cosmic forces of the appropriate type will stoke it. Just as the devout Catholic is inspired by the influences of his patron saint, invoked by prayer, so the neurotic is hag-ridden by his obsessive demon, invoked by the morbid broodings of the dissociated subconsciousness. The occultist maintains that the generalized principle of evil has its intelligent channels, just as the organized principle of good has its ministering spirits. Any observer who considers the phenomena of mental disturbance will find much to support this hypothesis. 59. The question of obsession is an exceedingly important one. The word is used very freely in occult circles, and is held to mean the withdrawal of a soul from its body and its replacement by another soul. But I doubt whether this is a true representation of what happens. It has always appeared to me that in obsession we have not got the actual replacement of one soul by another, but the complete domination of one soul by another. It is a hypnotic domination, and we can explain it in terms of the known psychology of hypnosis, the hypnotist in the case being an astral entity. There is an operation in magic known as assuming the god form, in which the operator identifies himself in imagination with the god and so becomes a channel for its power. It is one of the special modes of Egyptian magic wherein the priest always wore a mask to represent the animal head symbolically attributed to the god he represented. This imaginative identification is a method well known in occultism and is often employed in order to enter into the inner life of a plant or a crystal as a mental exercise. The effects of it are very marked and very peculiar. I am inclined to think that it is this method, combined with hypnosis, which is used by the obsessing entity, which first identifies itself with its victim and then superimposes its own personality upon his, thus obtaining a vehicle of manifestation. I am also of the opinion, however, that it is only in certain abnormal states, whether induced by disease of mind or body, or by some of the more drastic operations of black magic, that this imposition can take place. Part 3. The Diagnosis of a Psychic Attack, Chapter 12, Methods Employed in Making a Psychic Attack. Anyone who reads the old books on witchcraft, usually compiled by the professional witchfinders from their confessions of alleged witches extorted under torture, will find that the phenomena described fall into certain broad categories which are so constant in different ages and in different parts of the world that we are left with the impression that there must be some fire behind so much smoke. The state records of witch trials in Scotland, the reports of a priest charged with the task of extirpating witchcraft in northern Italy, the archives of Brittany, the stories of magic in classical literature, and finally, travelers' accounts of the practices of primitive people all over the world, all corroborate each other, agreeing as to the phenomena described, the explanations given by the witches of their methods, and the broad divisions into which the phenomena fall. We must first take account of the use of drugs, of which the black fraternity in all ages have possessed a remarkable knowledge. Potions, unguents and fumigations were used extensively, and among all the weird and wonderful ingredients of which they were composed we now and again find substances which are known to be medicinally potent. The poppy which gives sleep and dreams, hemp which gives visions, datura which produces loss of memory, blighted grains which produce abortion, certain insects which are powerfully aphrodisiac, certain barks which are effectually an aphrodisiac, and, in the New World, the buds of a certain cactus and m-semicolon, all these and many others play their part in the witch booze. Paracelsus earned fame by turning some of the traditional magical brews to medicinal purposes. The Borgias earned infamy by employing them as subtle poisons which destroyed the mind without necessarily destroying the body. It is related that the Roman philosopher Lucretius was driven insane by a magical draught given him by his wife in order to restore to her his lost affections. There exist old recipes for witch unguents which contain opium and cantharids. It is not difficult to imagine what manner of dreams would come in the sleep thus induced. C. S. Oliveira, 60, in his recent book, Analysis of Magic and Witchcraft, gives it as his opinion that attendance at the Sabbat was often achieved by means of drug-induced dreams. Subtle poisons also undoubtedly play a part in the effectiveness of curses, a favorite method being to make a talisman of brass, copper or lead, and fasten it inconspicuously at the bottom of a drinking vessel or cooking pot. What effect the talisman had is conjectural, but there is no doubt at all about the effect of the steady dissolving of small quantities of lead and verdigris in the food. But while all these things were a part, and a considerable part, of the witch cult, they cannot, strictly speaking, be considered a psychic method of attack, and we only refer to them in these pages in order that their effects may be excluded from the diagnosis. There are three factors in a psychic attack, any or all of which may be employed in a given instance. The first of these is telepathic hypnotic suggestion. The second is the reinforcement of the suggestion by the invocation of certain invisible agencies. The third is the employment of some physical substance as a point of contact, or magnetic link. The force employed may be used as direct current, transmitted by the mental concentration of the operator, or it may be reserved in a kind of psychic storage battery, which may be either an artificial elemental or a talisman. In Chapter 2 we have considered in some detail the psychology of suggestion, and need not repeat what has already been said, save to remind the reader that the essence of telepathy consists in the sympathetic induction of vibration. Experimental psychologists are already suspecting that emotion is closely akin to electricity. They have proved conclusively that emotional states alter the electrical conductivity of the body. The occultist believes that emotion is a force of an electrical type, and that in the case of the ordinary man it radiates out from him in all directions, forming a magnetic field, but in the case of the trained occultist it can be concentrated into a beam and directed. Supposing you are able to concentrate your whole attention upon a single feeling, inhibiting all else, you will have achieved a pure emotional state, unadulterated and undiluted. All the life force coming into your soul will therefore flow in this single subdivision of a single channel instead of in the many ramifications of the usual three channels previously referred to. The concentration will be terrific, but it will only be achieved at a terrific price. It is in order to achieve this terrible concentration that the saints of the West and the yogis of the East practice a torturing asceticism. You must sell all that you possess in order to purchase this pearl of great price, and an echo of the method lingers in the fairy tale tradition that the person who finds the lucky stone can only have one wish. Such a concentration is good for one purpose, and one purpose only. We can concentrate on a healing, or on a destruction, but we cannot work at both simultaneously, neither can we readily change over from one to the other. We cannot combine incompatibles within the limits of a single life. That is to say, if we have concentrated on a work of malediction and death in order to achieve an act of revenge, our rage being satiated, we cannot immediately reverse the spin of the soul and reconcentrate upon works of wisdom and redemption. We may liken the soul moving with the tide of evolution to a wheel spinning clockwise, audiosal, and a soul moving against the tide of evolution to a wheel spinning counterclockwise, or widdershins. The position of the axle can be altered so that the wheel revolves at any angle without the direction of its revolution being affected, but the flywheel has to be stopped before the engine can be reversed, and a big flywheel takes a great deal of stopping. Moreover, in order to reverse the flywheel, we have to stop the engine. The normal movement of the soul is diurnal, forward with the current of evolution. We need to think many times before we undertake to reverse that spin even momentarily, in order to undertake a work of malediction and death. The old saying, "There is the devil to pay," is a true one. Indeed, it is questionable whether there is such a thing as a momentary reversal of spin. Momentum has to be checked and worked up again before reversal of spin can take place. Very great forces can be developed by this subjective concentration of the mind itself, but even greater forces can be rendered available if we apply the mechanical equivalent of gearing, if, in other words, While this tremendous concentration is being held, we pick up the contacts of the corresponding cosmic force. We use the powers of the human mind as a self-starter, and as soon as its lesser driving wheel is flying round merrily, we throw in the clutch of the main engine. There is a brief period of struggle as the little machine forces over the reluctant levers of the great machine, then the vapor fires and the engine takes up its work. After that it is only a matter of engaging the gears and driving, if you can. So it is with ceremonial magic. Let us consider a concrete case of someone who wants to avail himself of a fighting force. He would have recourse to a ceremony of the planet Mars. He would therefore gather together in his temple all that was appropriate to Mars. He would drape his altar with a scarlet cloth, he would himself wear a scarlet robe. All his magical implements would be of iron and his rod of power would be a naked sword. Upon his altar he would place 5 lights, 5 being the number of Mars. Upon his breast would be the symbol of Mars engraved upon a steel pentagon. On his hand would be a ruby ring. He would burn sulfur and salt through in his thurible. Then, according to the work in hand, he would call upon the angelic or demonic aspect of the fifth sephira, Jebra, the sphere of Mars. He would invoke either the deity name in Jebra, calling upon the god of battles to hear him, or the archdevil of the fifth infernal habitation. Having performed this mighty invocation, he would then offer himself upon the altar as the channel for the manifestation of the force. There are many formulae extant designed to enable a force to be brought through without the necessity of the magician himself being the channel. In my opinion, they are one and all ineffectual, the only possible substitute for the magician himself being a trance medium. It is for this reason that ritual magic so often fails to come off. You cannot make custards without breaking eggs, and if you mean to be a magician, you have got to go the whole hog. When it is a question of bringing through the angelic aspect of a force, the matter is on a clear footing. To be the channel of such a force is a great privilege and is an initiation in itself. The operator has simply to eliminate from his nature all incompatibles and maintain his concentration without wavering. The worst that can happen is that he should fail to obtain his results. But when it comes to bringing through the demonic aspect of a sphere, the matter is on an entirely different footing. Very few people care to offer themselves for the manifestation of such a force as Asmodeus. I do not believe that there is any reliable device for invoking the devils without being obsessed by them save the method of a bromelin, which involves 6 months' preparation and is only operated after the knowledge and conversation of the holy guardian angel have been attained. The edge of the abyss is well fenced. It is not possible to fire a GNN and avoid the recoil. Having invoked and concentrated his force, our sorcerer has next to consider his target. He has to get into astral contact with his victim. In order to do this, he must form a rapport, not quite as easy as might be imagined. First he has to find his victim and establish a point of contact in his sphere, and then, working from this space, succeed in piercing his aura. An unfocused force is not very much use. A focus has to be achieved. The usual method is to obtain some object which is impregnated with the intended victim's magnetism, a lock of hair, nail paring, or something habitually worn or handled. Such an object is magnetically connected with its owner, and the sorcerer can work up the trail and thus enter the sphere of his victim and establish a rapport. He then proceeds as does any other practitioner of suggestion who has succeeded in getting his victim into the first stages of hypnosis. By means of the magnetic link he has gained the psychic ear of his victim, who will hear his suggestions subconsciously. It now remains to be seen whether the thought seeds thus planted will strike root or be cast out from the mind. In any case, the victim is rendered disturbed and uneasy. If a magnetic link cannot be obtained, the practitioner of black magic has to fall back upon other devices. One of the most common is that of substitution. Something is chosen and by means of ceremonial is identified with the intended victim. For instance, a small animal may be baptized with the victim's name, and then immolated, usually with torture, the operator meanwhile concentrating upon the personality of the original. The old device of making a wax image and melting it before a fire, or driving nails into a wooden statue, baptized with the name of the victim, are frequently met with in the records of witch trials. The actual driving of the nail has no conceivable effect upon the victim, but it helps the concentration of the operator. The talismanic method in various forms is also employed. A talisman is a symbol representing a certain force, or combination of forces, depicted upon a suitable substance and magnetized by ritual.